You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 56, Special Religious Underwear. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including new posters from Bye Bye Robot, Hasbro's Creo stop-motion project, TNG Blu-ray extras, and the sale of the original Shuttle Galileo. Plus, we examine Greg's iMessage stream of consciousness while watching Star Trek Generations. Then in the feature, we're joined by Tristan Riddell to discuss DS9's Circle Trilogy, The Homecoming, The Circle, and The Siege. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I am doing well. I am slightly redder than you may remember. Well, part of me is redder than you may remember last week.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you're bringing a whole new meaning to the term redneck there.
Yes, my neck is red. My arms are red. Part of my forehead is red. Yes, the sun, they keep calling it the sun. It's apparently a star around which Earth orbits. And it has come out here in Seattle. And it's like 80 degrees, which means people are dying of heat stroke. And yeah, it's...
Wait. People are dying when it's 80 degrees? Well, what kind of weather pansies are you guys up there
exactly.
in Seattle?
Meanwhile, I've got friends in South Carolina. You know, our friends over at Dork Trek are dealing with like 115 degrees and 125 degrees.
In Virginia for them, yeah.
You know, with the heat index, and here it's 80, and people are like, oh my God, maybe I should take off my North Face jacket. But but seriously, today it was very sunny, and I was out. I was shooting headshots for a comedian. You know, email me. I provide my services. And it was very sunny, basically. And I didn't even notice, but I completely, once I got on camera, I realized I am completely baked. Baked in a different way than most of Seattle right now. Baked as in I have sunburn.
That you do. It's quite a sight.
Not like Keanu Reeves in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
In fact, it's so bad I've had to switch my display, at least for your video stream, to black and white mode.
I bet that would help.
My glasses just aren't doing the job. Now, Greg, I have a question. You sent me a message and you said a sample of what I was doing today. And then you sent me a picture of this guy.
Now, he's a very handsome man.
Now, what does that mean?
No. What it means, Chris, I guess I should explain this on the air. I was shooting headshots. I was shooting professional headshots. This guy is a comedian in Seattle. He has a new agent. They need to send photo, headshots around to casting agencies. He wants to get, you know, cast in the next Star Trek movie as an ensign, soon to be a captain. But he needs headshots, and this is a service I provide. So no, when I say I was doing this man, I mean I was taking pictures of him with my DSLR camera. That's clarification.
I was just a little confused the way it came through.
I know,
and especially on the iMessage feed there.
And you knew that I was supposed to be on a date today, and that didn't happen. So you know, things get confusing when you're on the iMessage. I understand.
Definitely, and especially with the message just before that one, which I won't read.
There's a lot that's on the iMessage. That's not just the other side of the room. That's like a completely different starship.
That's right. It goes way beyond the other side of the room. All right, Greg. So, well, it's quite toasty here as well.
Oh, yeah?
The sun's come out. It finally feels like summer. I have not become a redneck myself yet. Maybe it's fortunate that I do have to stay indoors most of the time. So no worries for me.
That is good.
All right. Well, Greg, we have a rather abbreviated news segment this week. I suppose because of it being the 4th of July in the United States last week.
Is that why there were fireworks? I thought. Wow.
Reportedly.
Huh.
It was either that or it was the court ruling in the Apple Samsung case.
That's what I was assuming at the time.
Yeah.
Because the injunction against the Nexus Genesis device, whatever. I lose track. All these Star Trek references. But no, apparently there's some sort of patriotic holiday. I don't know. Too much time in Japan. I just lose track of these things. But yeah, there wasn't much news at all. I don't think there's any, you know, movie news and rumors for us to talk about.
Nope, there's no movie news and rumors this week. But we do have a mailbag. And since we won't have our movie music, Greg, I have a little lead-in mailbag music for you this week.
Nice.
AK-47, well, you know it makes me feel all right. Got an Uzi by my pillow, helps me sleep a little better at night. There's no feeling any greater than to shoot first and ask questions later. Now I'm trigger happy every day. Well, you can't take my guns away, I gotta come.
So, Greg, this may describe one of our recent listeners, Trigger Happy Klingon, who we talked about, I believe, last week, who we understood had listened to every minute of every discussion we have recorded over the course of 1 week. But apparently that's not quite true.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he says, I guess I should just read what he says. He says he's listening to episode 55 now, and he says his iTunes review lost a little in translation from the Klingon, which I understand how that can be. He meant to say that he's listened to all the episodes in the last 2 weeks, not just 1 week. So it's that he listened to hours, and it's not like he listened to however many episodes that is, like 100 hours in 1 week. No, he listened to 100 hours in 2 weeks.
I see. So much more manageable.
Right. It's not like he spent every hour of every day. It's just that he spent an entire work week plus overtime listening to us for two straight weeks, which is much more reasonable, I guess.
I guess so. I think Trigger Happy Klingon must be an expert on the Ready Room at this point.
Probably more than us at this point.
Probably more knowledgeable about the Ready Room than even we are. Even if it was done over the course of 2 weeks.
Yeah.
He says that he could not stand to listen to humans for over 100 hours a week, which I can understand, especially if those two humans are us. So,
yes, very much so.
So this was from our Facebook page. Trigger Happy Klingon did drop by our Facebook page to clarify his listening habits. And so if anyone else wants to drop by our Facebook page, it's a very easy to find, facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook, it's a very popular site. You may have heard of it.
I've heard that.
And we're there. So thank you, Trigger Happy Klingon, for dropping us a line and letting us know the methods of your listening madness.
Now, here's my question real quick. Now, when a Klingon uses a gun, you know, when a Klingon hits someone with a batleth, it doesn't lacerate them or stab them or cause blood to come out in any way. So when you shoot somebody like with a gun and you're a Klingon, does it just sort of go whoop, and just sort of knock them backwards and they sort of, or when you shoot them with a phaser, it just sort of goes whoop, whoop, like a Batman, like, you know, kapow.
Yeah, I think so. Huh. That's how all Klingon weapons work.
Klingon weapons are interesting devices. I don't know quite how they work. You think they'd want disruptors or lacerations or various bloody, messy ways of dealing with their enemies. But apparently they're quite clean. They don't like the sight of blood, apparently.
No, they only like to drink it. They don't like to actually see it. They're a very tidy bunch, those Klingons. Oh, you know what I want to see is I want to see Dax go into the holosuite and ask the computer for a Klingon gun. And I want to see how she describes the Klingon gun, what kind of grip it has, you know, what kind of material it's made of. And then, of course, the computer would say, yeah, got it. Gun. Whatever.
Right, just
here you go.
A gun. Yes.
That's what we need to see.
Oh, Jadzia.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, let's move on into some other news, Greg. So what do we have up first in non-trigger happy news?
Yes, we have more from Bye Bye Robot, which is that illustration company that's gotten the Star Trek license recently and is making these really incredible prints. There was the ones of the whales, and then the one with the Enterprise sort of in space against this really cool space background. They've done this time is they're done by illustrator Jeff Foster, and they're calling them impressionistic posters. So instead of being like hyper-realistic or cartoony, like kind of the other ones were, these are you know, sort of a I'm going to say the wrong one, but Monet or Manet. I'm really bad with artists. The one that was an impressionist.
Yes, that's what they look like, and they are really nice. I mean, again, this is the kind of artwork that you could hang in your home if you're a Star Trek fan, but maybe your wife doesn't want to have the Galileo shuttle flying over a landscape. In the living room, you might be able to get her to go in for one of these, either Hunting for Prey, which is a very beautiful painting of three Klingon birds of prey flying in front of, I guess, what looks like kind of a reddish nebula.
Okay.
And then there's Exploration, which is the movie version of the Constitution-class Enterprise. Of course, I can't tell if it's the original Enterprise or the Enterprise A because of the Impressionist style, but either way, it's a very nice painting.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably, it's either the refit or the A, I think. And this is the one I really like because it's just the colors jump out at me, but it's not garishly Star Trek. It's the sort of thing you could, hang in your living room and someone would see it and they looked at it. They'd be like, oh, that's Star Trek. But it's not like you're just hanging a Star Trek poster in your living room.
Right.
This is the one I'd really want. But the one with the birds of prey is really cool as well. I definitely hope we see some more of these coming in the future. And they're only $25. I mean, a whole poster, you get a print for just $25. That's a really great price for some fantastic artwork.
Yeah, definitely, yes. I'm surprised by the price, actually. Very inexpensive. They do say that the initial launch includes Exploration and Hunting for Prey. So it does imply that maybe Jeff Foster will be doing additional Impressionist artwork for Star Trek, for Bye Bye Robot in the future.
Yeah, I'm really hoping to see Spock and Uhura hugging, but impressionistic. maybe Scotty teleporting a beagle in an impressionistic style.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of stuff in the JJ film.
Yeah, but I have to admit, the one I'm most waiting for is that scene from Generations with Geordi doing a barrel roll impressionist style.
Very good. Can we go on a half hour tangent about Generations now, or should we save that?
Now that you bring that up, Greg, I actually did want to talk to you about the stream of consciousness over the weekend where you sent me I don't know how many messages on iMessage, and then I saw you tweet a screenshot of iMessage and say, "Still iMessaging, C. Brian Jones."
Yep.
Still no response. As I was in the middle of the day working here.
I guess you were working.
So
I guess.
I did want to ask you about a few of these things now.
Okay.
So, let's first of all, what on earth did they tell Worf when getting him on the holodeck?
Right. And this is, they're there at the beginning and they're all doing this mock trial for Worf. And everybody's dressed, including Worf. Everyone's dressed in the period clothing for the Enterprise. Did they tell Worf that he was going to be on trial? I mean, did they tell him it was a birthday party? What exactly did they tell this guy to manage to get him into the holodeck wearing full naval gear? Theories.
Yeah, you don't imagine he would have willingly gone in to do that, right?
Right, exactly.
I don't know. Maybe they just told him that, like, let's go to the holodeck. We're going to hang out for a while, and then Data's going to push Beverly into the water, and it's going to be hilarious, and you're going to love it.
That's actually one of my favorite parts of the film, is when Data pushes Beverly. I know Geordi says it's not funny, but it is. It's really, really funny.
It actually is funny. One before that was the B is the only ship in range. They're in the asteroid belt of the Sol system, and they're the only ship in range.
Right. I mean, it's not even like the Nexus is anywhere near Earth. It's that the B is the only ship in the system, and there's something going on sort of kind of nearby, but it's really like over near where the Elorians live. But the B is the only ship that can make it there in any sort of reasonable amount of time. Like, seriously, is there not a perimeter defense fleet? I mean, we got into this in all of the previous things, but that's when, like, okay, there's a whale probe coming for Earth. I sort of get, for some reason, they're the only ship. I don't know why, but I can buy that. They're the only ship that can protect Earth, just because it has to be important. But how can they be near Earth and be the only ship that can help someone else?
Well, it's like the lines in the original series. We're the only ship in the quadrant.
Right.
I believe that comes from another, from a TOS movie, actually. But
I think it does.
We're the only ship in the quadrant. It's like everyone else, they went over to the beta quadrant, you know, to check out something over there.
That's one thing. If you don't like the JJ film, you have to admit there's a bunch of ships at Earth that all go to try to help Vulcan and they get blown up. It's not like, oh, Vulcan's being attacked. This ship full of cadets is the only ship in range. No, they actually had a bit of an explanation for that.
Or maybe it's like in DS9. Was it the Valiant? Was that the Defiant class ship that Red Squad had and all the adults in the ship were killed? So only these Red Squad cadets could fly around and fight in the war? So, sometimes it's like, okay, writers, can you just please try a little bit harder?
Yeah.
And it begs the question of why is Earth completely undefended in the Star Trek universe? There's never anyone around to defend Earth.
Yeah. And there's apparently perimeter defenses of some sort that Nero has to like bring down. That's why he kidnaps Pike, is he needs the code. So I guess there's like turbo lasers, or it's like that big nipple gun from Empire Strikes Back. We've got some of those, but there don't appear to be just starships just sort of hanging out. What does, you know, the Bozeman, certainly Captain Frazier, doesn't have anything terribly important to be doing. He could be hanging out around Earth.
And don't you also think that building your defense perimeter around Mars or Jupiter, when you're dealing with enemies with ships that travel at light speed, isn't it a little bit close? Wouldn't you want to have your defense perimeter like beyond Pluto or somewhere?
You would think. I mean, okay, there's Worf 359. Apparently they did a defensive perimeter there. Don't write us in about Worf 359, but B's the only ship in range. Was there anything else from the stream of consciousness?
Yes, there's this one, which I definitely want to know about. I hope there's a non-canon novel that explains the Ferengi joke at Farpoint Station.
You know, this was a good chance. You know, Ron and Brannon were writing All Good Things and Generations at the same time. They're writing them concurrently. Couldn't they have slipped the Ferengi joke into the pre-Farpoint? Well, I don't know, just somehow slip it in there. Just as a little Easter egg for fans. But no, this Ferengi joke that comes out of nowhere doesn't make, what is it? There's the Ferengi in the clown suit, the Ferengi in the gorilla suit has to go.
Yes, right.
Something like that.
I think there is a novel, isn't it? Star Trek The Next Generation, number 147 from Pocket Books, which is titled Gorilla Suit. I think that actually does explain
Gorilla
the joke.
Suit. So you should. Okay, I'll have to look that one up.
You could probably get it in Kindle format.
Probably.
Okay, so that was one. Do you think Data in the future in All Good Things was actually B4? Okay, no.
Yeah. Oh, you don't?
Not B4. No. Because that's an alternate timeline that branched off prior to Nemesis.
But either way, Shinzon's going to come and Shinzon's going to attack. I don't know. I haven't seen anything particularly in the timeline. I mean, okay, there's the Worf Riker split. Apparently didn't happen. Riker went ahead and got married to Troy. And so far, we've not seen any sign that Picard and Crusher are getting married. But the rest of it seems like it's going in the same path, and there's nothing stopping Picard and Crusher from getting married, really.
I would just ask you, did B4 show you any signs that he would ever be capable of being a professor at Cambridge?
But if you read the Star Trek Countdown comic book that takes place before the JJ film but after Nemesis, you see a fully functioning B4. That's Data, because they transferred Data's memories into B4. They just took a little while to develop, but he just became this reborn Data.
Oh, really? So he's fully functional. That's what you said in the comic. Fully functional. Yar came back also in the comic? Wow. Okay. Sounds kind of racy for IDW, but All right. Okay, a few more quick ones, and then we should get on to the okay. news here. Of course, there was the make the teal uniforms go away.
Yes. Oh, God, I hate them so much.
Did Alyssa have her baby between All Good Things and Generations? She isn't
This is important. Alyssa, she Alyssa Ogawa, she's having sex all through the series, finally gets pregnant. I've been tracking this. She's pregnant in All Good Things, and then it's a plot device because the... what was it? Or no, it was a plot device in an episode leading up to All Good Things, right? Now I'm getting my things mixed up.
I think so. I don't remember exactly, but...
Oh, Genesis. It was okay. A plot device in Genesis because the baby...
Because the baby...
I think they used the baby to heal everyone or something. I don't remember.
I don't know. Or did they use Genesis. Data's cat's babies? Oh, that was the discovery, was that...
Right.
That Spot, Data's, who is a male cat, had kittens and the kittens were unaffected, right?
Well, that's because of Beverly's twin sister that did the sex change. But yes, Spot yes. was an iguana, but her kittens, his kittens, were not. They were just kittens. They weren't iguana kittens. So they made that discovery, and something, God, yes, they let Gates McFadden direct an episode, and well, that was a bad idea. But anyway, she was still, Alyssa was still pregnant in All Good Things, but then Generation comes and no mention of this child. She's just, and she's not even showing.
Maybe Data pushed her in the water. I don't know.
they do talk about Alyssa's baby, actually. It's a character in the Titan series.
Okay.
So I know that the baby came at some point. We just, it's so important. Maybe there's a deleted scene. Maybe instead of the prologue in the 23rd century, there's a whole scene about Alyssa having her baby in the 24th century. And one of these days we'll get a Blu-ray release that'll reveal all.
It'll probably be on there. All right. Okay. And the last one before we go on, Troy at the helm to coolant leak is less than 90 seconds. When will they learn? That said, LaForge certainly knows how to transition from coolant leak into barrel roll.
He really does. I mean, if you look at it, like, they defeat the Klingons, and it's like, you know, the extra does the little yes, and then Data does the yes. And then it's basically immediately the entire ship falls apart. And it Geordi kind of just gives up. He's like, oh, there's sort of a problem. Oh, coolant leak. Okay, we're done. Wrap her up. One starship in starship scrap heap.
That's right. If it happened during the series, he would have stopped the coolant leak. But yes. Because it's in this movie, oh no, there's no way I can handle we're this done. Situation. So I'm done. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. And then you've got the hammy extra in the background going, yes, to steal Data's moment, right?
Right. Well, and then there's the extra that does the barrel roll and then sort of looks at LaForge sheepily as LaForge comes out and does the barrel roll too.
Oh, right. He's like, you're not showing me up on that one.
And you're skipping over Data, like, holding Troy. Have you ever noticed this? Data, like, holds Troy as they're mm-hmm. crashing. There's incredible model shots. What's Data? Why is he holding? Anyway.
Well, that emotion chip is really kicking in there.
I suppose so.
Yes. All right. Why don't we move on to the rest of the news here?
We should.
Next, we have Hasbro Creo. You remember, we talked about this a long time mm-hmm. ago, about these Creo figures they were coming out with. Well, apparently, they are putting together a stop-motion short film that's going to be produced by Bad Robot. Now, for those who aren't familiar with Creo, they're basically like Legos, but they're made by Hasbro, and I mm-hmm. guess they're maybe a little bit larger. I'm not positive on that. But they're pretty much like Legos. And so, mm-hmm. Greg, did you have a look at this? It's not the actual short yet. I think that's coming out maybe... It says spring 2013, so I'm wondering mm-hmm. if it's going to be like before the movie, kind of like Pixar always does a short.
Yeah, that's the sense I got from it.
But did you have a look at this little teaser trailer that they put out?
I did, yeah. And this is the teaser trailer they'll be showing at Comic-Con coming up in a week or two. Yeah, it's really cool. It looks like those, they do Lego Star Wars short films every once in a while. It sort of looked like that. It was a takeoff on the original JJ teaser trailer where they're sort of constructing the Enterprise. Only now they're constructing it out of Creo blocks. But it looked really cool. And it said the Bad Robot is actually the ones producing it. It'd be really interesting to see. Like, will it be sort of like the Lego Star Wars, where it was sort of joking around with the premise? Because Lego Star Wars was really what's the word? It was really like self-referential and very irreverent. And it'd be really cool if they do the same thing with Star Trek here coming up. But this is basically all I know is that this little teaser that we've seen now.
Right. So I was really glad to see they're doing this because I've been really bummed over the years that there haven't been any Star Trek Legos. You have all this Star Wars stuff coming out and zero Star Trek. And
yeah,
I don't know if it's because CBS and Paramount haven't been interested in licensing it to them or if Lego feels like they can't do Star Wars and Star Trek both or if George Lucas doesn't want Lego to do Star Trek in addition or... I don't know what it is.
There might be a Hasbro licensing deal where they have rights to all Star Trek toys or something.
So I'm glad to see them doing this because I'm not so interested in, say, a Creo ship, but I would love to have the figures themselves in that style.
Yeah, the figures would be really cool. I mean, I like the look of the Creo Enterprise. It's really cool. I mean, I have the little plush Enterprise toy that I play around with every once in a while. It'd be cool to have this too. You know, just, you know, as you're building your living room and you've got the, you know, the Jeff Foster painting and you've got your plush Enterprise and you've got your Empress Hoshi, you know, figure and you've got your Admiral Adama desk. You know, it'd be good to just have one of these Creo Enterprises to put on the desk. You know, it's just part of adding a little bit of extra conversation pieces to your living room.
It would be cool.
Subtle things.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I hope that they do is I would love to see them do some Creo video games, say for iPad or PlayStation or Xbox, the way that they have done with the Star Wars and the Harry Potter and the Indiana Jones Legos.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Because those are fun to play, especially if you have kids. You know, my son and I played through all the Star Wars Legos together on PlayStation, and it's really fun. So we'll see. They're going to have their booth at the, well, I guess by the time we record this, maybe it's already happened. San Diego Comic-Con is actually this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, it's coming up. I believe it's this coming weekend. It's not the weekend we're currently in, but as you listen to the show, it will be coming up this Friday through Sunday, I believe.
Okay. So they're going to have a booth there. It's booth 3213. That's, I guess, the Hasbro booth. Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to see for the first time in person the Creo Enterprise, Kirk, Spock, and Bones figures, and see what it's all about. And like you said, they're going to be showing the little teaser that we've watched as well. So
it looks like this is going to be the only bit of JJ film that's actually going to be at Comic-Con because they've already said they're not going to be doing a panel. So this might be pretty much all there is to it until next year.
Yeah, it looks that way. All right. Well, one thing that we'll get sooner than next year is the TNG Season 1 Blu-ray release, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks for you guys over there in the States.
Yeah, I'm really excited. You know, the 23rd is, I believe, 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Yeah.
If I'm doing the math in my head right. I have my tickets. I bought two tickets. I don't know who's getting the other ticket. If you're listening to this right now...
Is it going to be that guy that you sent me on iMessage?
No, I don't believe I'll be taking him with me. I should clarify. If you're in the Seattle area and you are an attractive female, please send me a message. Or if you're willing to make a flight, you know... You know, Tanya or over in Moscow, you know, if you'd like to join me at Star Trek, I'm more than happy to, but you're going to have to pay your way. I'll provide the ticket. You have to provide the travel and lodging.
That's right, everyone. Greg is now using the ready room to get dates.
I've got to use everything. I've got to, you know, everything I can get.
All right. So you have your tickets for the screening.
I have my tickets. I'm excited. It's going to be really fun. We're going to see a couple episodes up on the screen. But then the next day will be the release of the Blu-ray set, the first season Blu-ray set, which I just finished season 7. And then Generations was sort of the epilogue for TNG. I just finished that. So now I'm ready to start all the way back at the beginning. But now in crystal clear, you know, 7.1 surround sound action and all of that. Really excited to see this. But of course, Chris, you're going to have the difficulty because you're out in Japan, which is the land of expensive things.
Well, Japan is not really the land of expensive things per se, but it is when it comes to anything apparently produced by CBS, because apparently they think that their DVD or Blu-ray sets are worth several bars of gold pressed latinum.
Right.
Well, first of all, our release date here is August 10th. Mm-hmm. And I would, and of course, that set, as I've talked about on here before, is selling for approximately $350. And Amazon Japan, they are now listing the import. Right. From the U.S., which of course would not have the Japanese audio tracks on it, which is, well, it's priced a bit more reasonably. It's about 10,000, 11,000 yen, but it still comes out in dollars to $136, which means it's still double what Walmart and Amazon U.S. is now selling it for. So I'm going to have to try to see if Amazon US can export, which they used to do all the time, and then suddenly they were no longer able to export Star Trek Blu-ray sets, and then those suddenly appeared in the Amazon Japan store for like triple the price. So there's definitely something going on there where they're just trying to make sure you can't buy them for less money. Not Amazon trying, but you know, I guess it would be CBS. They're the distributor, so it's a real shame. But I don't know when I'll get my hands on them. Is the bottom line?
Right. So we'll try to have a show about them. We'll find some way to get you a copy of the special features. I was saying I was going to just put the webcam, you know, turn it towards the TV, and we can sort of watch it together. We'll figure something out. But one thing, they're sort of releasing in drips and drabs, little bits of interesting information. And we saw a little bit here and there. I saw some exclusive images of a new planet with the Enterprise composited over it. It looked very nice. But then one really cool thing that came out this week was a featurette on those little people moving around inside the conference room, you know, having a staff meeting during the opening titles of the show. And it turns out that it wasn't even filmed people. It was actually a little animation that was actually done with what looked like little stick figures, kind of.
Yeah, I think they were actually sketches, if I understand correctly, which is really, really interesting because I always thought that they were... Well, I don't know what I thought, really. I guess I basically thought they were actually people and they had shot that and then they had composited that. But then again... Yeah. You know, the ship's a model, so I don't know exactly what I thought that was, but I never thought about it being sketches, which is kind of clever and interesting. And so in this special feature that's going to be on the Blu-ray set, they actually will go into and describe the whole process, you know, how that came about, how they decided to do it, how they executed it. And StarTrek.com sat down and talked with Mike and Denise Okuda about it. And they have a lot of information on the site. And we're not going to go into it right now, you know, and tell you all the details because it'll be interesting to watch on the Blu-ray. But I'm really looking forward to seeing this.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I noticed actually while watching Generations, you know, they reused a lot of shots from the series in Generations because why not? And actually, when they reuse shots or that shot, in the movie, it didn't have little people in there. And what it sounds like is they didn't even know that this footage still existed. So when they were putting together Generations, they just took the shot of the ship, put some white in there, sort of blew it out, and composited it over the starfield, called it a day. But when making the Blu-ray, they were so, you know, it was so important to have it match the original show. They really scoured the archives to find this bit of footage. And they were really excited because they were going to just, you know, recreate it with computers or whatever. But it sounds like they were really excited to find the actual footage again. And this is just an example of how different this is from the TOS remastering, where they're trying to use every single element from the original show that they possibly can. And I really respect that.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful that they're doing that. And I think we're going to be amazed that there are going to be a lot of things that we think have been recreated, but actually they did that work in the 80s and early 90s. And we just weren't able to see the details. So
I mean, it's astonishing that Jonathan Frakes was actually that young. Once upon a time, this isn't digital. They didn't digitally take his beard off and de-age him and, you know, make him skinnier. No, that's actually, they found footage of Jonathan Frakes as a very good looking young man and were able to cut that into the Next Generation.
Oh, you know, this might be worth $350 US for me. I don't know. Look into that. All right, Greg. Well, last news item we have today. We talked a couple of months ago about the original shuttle Galileo that was for sale. We also gave people advice that if they wanted to buy it, they should bring an extra tire because one of the tires was flat on the trailer. Well, there has been an auction and the shuttle Galileo has sold for $60,000.
$60,000? That's you mean like 6,000 yen. That is what you intended to say.
Yeah, that's about what the dollar is worth these days. Yeah.
Right. Was Q in the back sort of, you know, just raising his hand, just raising the price? Actually, apparently that is what happened. Sort of in the last couple hours, there was a lot of bidding and it really jacked up the price and it ended up going for this high amount to a group. And I'm Galileo Reconstruction or something like that is the name of the group that are actually... They're looking to really redo it and take it from the kind of pitiful state it's in right now and really restore it and make it fantastic and take it to different places in the US and show it off. And so it was important to them to have the original Galileo base and not just, you know, create a brand new Galileo. So it's good that it went to somebody like this who's really interested in doing something great with it and not to somebody who's going to, you know, stick it in their living room next to their Admiral Adama desk.
So say we all.
Yeah, absolutely. Or someone who's going to just pull it around to go to campgrounds because they think it would be cool to barbecue outside the shuttle Galileo. But
well, isn't that episode of DS9 where they happen upon that planet where like no electronics work and they have their starship, but they call it the cabin? Yeah. That's what I imagine this being used for. It's just in somebody's backyard. They call it the cabin. It doesn't work. That's right. It's like growing vegetables inside of it.
You want to come over to the cabin this weekend? Oh, yeah. But yeah, these are two men, Alec Peters and Adam Schneider. And as you said, they're running a project called Galileo Restoration. And yeah, that's what they're going to do. And they're going to fix it up. So at this point, basically, we'll just have to keep our eyes open and find out how the project goes and I'll let you know what happens, I'm sure, along the way. I imagine it'll take a while. You know, I've been around people who have restored old vintage cars before, and I know it's really tough, especially when you have a car. Sometimes it's hard to find original parts because they don't make the parts anymore. It's going to be really hard to find original parts for a Starfleet shuttle from the 23rd century.
It really will be, especially when you had Scotty, like, futzing around with it so much, like, really just screwing with the innards. There's going to be a lot of work that goes into that. I mean, just finding, you know, the warp drive to stick inside or the impulse drives.
Yeah.
I mean, they just don't, you can't just go into a scrapyard and pick them up like you used to be able to.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. You're probably going to have to just try to convert a couple of phasers to see if those can power the shuttle. So,
God.
All right. Well, we'll keep you updated on this story as news comes around. Now, there's another auction, Greg, that's coming up on July 28th in Los Angeles. And this one is being run by Profiles in History. And they have like a whole assortment of stuff that they're selling here. And one of them is the captain's chair from the Enterprise E.
That's very
which
cool.
They are estimating will sell for between $60,000 and $80,000. Now, these estimates are always like way, way off the mark when it comes to Star Trek memorabilia, which always goes for far more than what they expected to. How much would you be willing to pay for the captain's chair from the Enterprise E?
Well, my question would be, does it come with the joystick?
I think the joystick would be a separate prop because it wasn't actually attached to the chair, was it?
Oh, I see. Well, okay. Can I send a text message from it?
That I believe you can do. It's very important. I think the Enterprise E had full Twitter integration throughout the bridge, at least. So you're okay there.
Right. Okay, good. Yeah. So, I mean, this is obviously out of my price range, but if you're one of the lucky few who can afford it, this would be a fantastic thing to have, especially if you're building a set or if this is really just going to go in a museum collection, as it's probably going to go. It's really awesome that it's for sale and not just stuck in a warehouse somewhere. And they got other stuff. I mean, they've got the Enterprise D dedication plaque. I can't believe that's being sold and isn't just, you know, in Rod Roddenberry's house. Like, it should just be in his house somewhere. Can't believe that's out there to be sold. One of those gold ships that Picard blew up.
Now, my question is, with the gold ship, are we going to get the broken one?
I would hope not.
I would pay extra for the broken one.
Oh, would you?
Well, yeah. You know, it's very authentic.
Pre-shattered.
Yeah. And I would have a button. Yeah. I would put it in a display case and I'd have a button. Actually, I wouldn't even do the button. I would do a motion sensor. When you walk by, Lily would say, you broke your little ships.
Nice. And there's a bunch of other stuff. Maybe just go and look at the list. The one thing I was confused about, Chris, it says Quark from DS9.
Yes, I saw that.
Now, does that include Armin Shimmerman or is it just the character himself?
I don't know. It says $3,000 to $8,000 and it really does sound like they're auctioning off Armin Shimmerman for $3,000.
I think he's worth a little bit more than that.
I think so. Yeah. I don't really know what that means because it's not like there was a statue of Quark that was like standing in a corner around the station all the time. So I don't know what that means.
I'm thinking it must mean either his uniform or like his ears and the makeup, you know, get up or both. Things you can use to transform yourself into Quark. I'm assuming something like that. Because they're also selling, you know, Seven of Nine's cat suit that, of course, I'm putting right onto the Empress Hoshi figure.
Empress Hoshi with the cat suit on. I don't know. I like Empress Hoshi with her little skirt on.
That's true.
Now, I will say with the Enterprise D dedication plaque, they're estimating $2,000 to $3,000. I actually, if I had $3,000 and I could grab that, I actually would probably buy that. And
I would go up to it. Yeah, I'd go up to $1,500 and it'd probably push me to about $2,000. Yeah, I could see that. I do think, though, it's going to go for much more than that. We'll have to check back after July 28th to see. I can't imagine for it going as low as $2,000.
No, I seriously would expect people could pay $20,000-$30,000 for that.
Oh, so easily.
I think it will go for a lot of money. So we'll find out. That's July 28th. You can go to profilesinhistory.com if you want to find out more about it and see what all they're selling. They're also they're auctioning off stuff from other series besides Star Trek as well. So there's a lot of stuff there.
Very cool.
Deep Space Nine kicked off its second season with a huge experiment. It was the first time in Star Trek history that the writers had attempted a three-part arc. And today we're going to talk about this story, known as the Circle Trilogy, which is The Homecoming, The Circle, and The Siege. And to help us talk about it, we have with us the person who was missing in action last week, the person who was just recently discovered, the person who hosts Hyper Channel, Tristan Riddell. Hello, Tristan.
Hey, guys. Sorry I couldn't make it last week. My Bajoran starfighter was stuck on some moon, and I couldn't get it working, and I really do apologize. But I'm here now. I got it working.
That's good.
And it's fine. It's not on fire or anything.
And you were not attacked by any creatures that may be spiders or maybe small dogs?
No, but they are quite meaty.
Here they are. They're really nice. Roast them over a fire. As you camp out there on those Bajoran moons.
That's what I was doing for the past week until I could get it started.
Nice.
All right. So let's talk about these three episodes. And It was interesting, and I was surprised when this first came on and they attempted to do a three-part story, because we were so used to getting these standalone stories on the Next Generation, and we started getting a few, you know, two-parters in the middle of seasons, like The Gambit, for example, or Chain of Command, but, you know, we didn't get a lot of stuff, so this was an interesting little take they had here.
Yeah, and it kind of started all the way back at the end of season one, when they had that episode, sort of like the Scopes Monkey Trial, where Kai Winn comes to the station and complains that Keiko's, you know, not teaching about the prophets in her school and all of that. And that sort of leads us into this. So they're painting this larger world, and it's really cool, because as much as TNG's been able to focus on the Klingons, it was sort of a thing that they could leave. They could forget about the Klingons for a season and then do another episode. You know, they'd forget that Alexander existed for a good two seasons. Then he'd just reappear because it was convenient. So, but the Bajorans and the Cardassians are something that are always there, and they always have to deal with them. And it was really smart of the writers to start dealing less in generalities, but start looking at some specifics. Like, let's look at who the leaders are. When there has to be a new leader, let's follow the political structure and the election of the new Kai to give it this more flavor. And I don't know if it's exactly what Star Trek fans wanted or what they were looking for after TNG, but it's a natural extension of what happens when you do a show that is set in one location.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad they took that angle myself, because I wanted to see more about that world and the Bajorans, and because it would have been in the first season, they had these like general standalone episodes a lot of the time. Of course, we often talk about Move Along Home. It's like, well, why do you bother to set up, you know, this station? You've got this wormhole, you've got this whole backstory about the Cardassian occupation of Bajor, and then instead you've got people hopping around in a cube like they're playing, I don't know, hopscotch or whatever games they're playing in there. So I'm glad that they started to really delve into the issues, and it did allow them to do what Deep Space Nine did best and what it did that the other series largely failed to do, which was to really truly delve into issues, not on a superficial level, but to really focus on the long-term consequences. And that's what we see here with this struggle of Bajor to recover from the occupation. And of course, naturally, you're going to have this infighting between factions within the government, and this kind of xenophobic response to, we want Bajor for Bajorans, is a natural thing that you might expect after what happened to that planet. You know, we saw that in Enterprise too, a little bit, where we had on Earth, they wanted to get everyone off of Earth who was not a Terran. And I think they even beat up Phlox at one point in San Francisco, right? So,
Phlox blew up like a blowfish, to scare him off.
Oh, that's right.
I remember watching these three episodes when they first came on the air, and I remember thinking, "Wow, okay, that's three in a row." At first, when I saw it, I was like, okay, this is a pain in the butt, because I want to know the story right away, because I was so used to TNG where it was one after the other, unless it was a season finale. But then I started thinking, I was like, okay, maybe this is what DS9 could be, what this is how DS9 could be known. And thankfully, that's how it became known in the future, especially with season 7 with that, what, 8-episode arc? It's like an 8-episode season finale.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's fantastic. And this was the first time that, like you said, that this was the first time that Star Trek ever attempted this. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I loved these episodes overall because of the introduction of all these Bajoran characters. And a lot of Star Trek fans don't like Bajorans. I mean, I feel like I've heard a lot of people bag... The only race that I've heard them bag on more is the Ferengi. And a big portion of what they don't like about the Bajorans is the religious aspect.
Right.
And they felt... that because whenever we saw religion in TNG, it was always superstition and old society. And Picard himself said that there was no place for it with the... Oh, man. What is the name of that episode where he was known as the Picard?
Oh, yes.
With the proto-Vulcans.
Right.
Yeah, that's who watches the Watchers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, who watches the Watchers. Thank you. Like that big, long speech about how, you know, they don't need to go into medieval times. But with the Bajorans, we see a different side of religion where it doesn't harm their society. And in fact, they have a literal connection with their gods.
Yeah.
Our, and that's why.
Our TOS editor, Drew Stewart, had a good tweet on our TOS Season 4 account this week. Where he basically, the crew goes to this planet that's, you know, a utopia, and it's a religious utopia, and Kirk spends the whole episode trying to find something wrong with it, because damn it, there must be something wrong with this, because there always is on TOS. But yeah, as you're saying, on Bajor, no, the prophets really aren't brainwashing anyone. There's no deep, dark secret behind the religion. It's just their religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a way, I haven't really thought about this before. I guess in a way, it's a bit akin to Buddhism in the sense that in Buddhism, you know, there is no God. Of course, in Japan anyway, the typical belief is that there is a God in everything. You know, like there's a God inside a rock. There's a God inside a tree. But it's not God in the sense of, say, how Christians look at God's like this supernatural being. It's about spirituality. It's more like a connection with nature and a connection with the universe in that sense. And you feel with the Bajorans, it's a little bit of that. I mean, their gods are aliens, but they don't know they're aliens, but they have this kind of very deep spiritual connection that for me, it is a bit different than say like a Christian view of religion. So so when Star Trek delves into it with the Bajorans, I feel like it's a great opportunity to talk about spirituality, perhaps more so than religion, if you want to kind of separate the definition of those terms.
Yeah, because when I guess it's Vedic Wynn comes to the station in the, I believe it's in The Hands of the Prophets, the season one finale, you know, Kira's not on her side. Kira's not some, you know, born again Bajoran who's saying, no, we must teach that the you know, wormhole comes from the prophets and all this stuff. Kira really kind of explains the way she thinks of it, that, you know, there's science and then there's these spiritual beliefs. And she believes there's not a contradiction, and she's not trying to force that contradiction, which I feel like, I actually do feel like TOS was always trying to force a contradiction between science and religion. I think that's part of Roddenberry's, if you say his agenda was to show that friction. Whereas DS9 seems a lot looser, similar to Battlestar Galactica, where science and religion can sort of coexist and there doesn't have to be a big problem unless you really get down and force it. And that's the big problem with Wynn and the Circle, where people are using religion to gain power.
Which is happening, of course, in the real world all the time.
Right.
So it's a very realistic a view of things.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Lee Nalis, because in The Homecoming, the impetus for everything that's happening moving forward through this story revolves around this hero of the resistance movement, Lee Nalis, who, it turns out, is still alive. Everyone thought he was dead, but he's alive on Cardassia 4 in some sort of a forced labor camp. And then, of course, Kira, in true Kira fashion, throws all caution to the wind and decides she's going to go rescue him. And not only that, but she's going to do it in a Starfleet runabout, taking it into Cardassian space to mount a rescue mission, which I found it kind of funny that she thought that Sisko would just hand her a runabout. It's like, sure, go invade the, you know, go to the solar system of one of our enemies and start a war and save this one person.
She really lucks out. Yeah. I mean, she really lucks out where she comes back and she isn't reprimanded, because the Cardassians kind of just up and apologize for still having a forced labor camp. I mean, I guess they were just really embarrassed and wanted to avoid an international incident, but this could have been a really big deal, something that Kira sparked.
Well, was anybody else really, really surprised at how gullible the guards were? that some random human and some random Majoran showed up. Like, what, he's a pimp and a prostitute that just go from planet to planet that walk through the desert? Yes. You know, I'm sorry. I was so overwhelmed by this thought that these guys must be so lonely.
Yeah.
That this was just, completely plausible to them.
And there are no questions like, can I see some identification? Where did you come from? It's like, let me see what I'm paying for here.
Right.
Yeah. You wonder, I mean, was there like a big city just like right on the other side of the mountain? Wouldn't you think? It's kind of odd, like you said, Tristan, that a human and a Bajoran woman who are not prisoners just come wandering around on this planet.
Yeah, it's like Kira just like walks up to the Cardassians. She's like, hey, I just met you and this is crazy, but here's my number. Sorry, guys. I just had to drop in a reference. But no, you're absolutely right. I
cannot believe you just said that.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
And then she said, call me sometime.
Yes.
But I like that guard's ability to judge distance. The way that he flips the force field back on right as O'Brien is about to walk through it. He really knows exactly where that force field is located.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, this whole shooting on location, having this whole fight between the Cardassians and Karen O'Brien, really cool scene. Like, it's impressive, and it's the sort of thing where if this were all contained in one episode, they wouldn't have time for it. Like, it would have started with Kira bringing Lee Nalis back. And it's like, oh, well, we discovered him somewhere, and they would have just explained it.
Yeah, they would have been coming out of the airlock at the beginning of the episode, right?
Exactly. But it's so much cooler to see Kira and O'Brien. I mean, Kira and O'Brien, what are we putting them together for? But have them go off on a mission. That's when a show can get really interesting, where you start pairing people up, see what that interaction's like, and show some bit of life outside of the station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoyed seeing the Miles and Kira pair, and it kind of made me think about how far things were going to go later on once Kira became pregnant with Miles' baby. I was just like, you guys have no idea what's in store for you. None whatsoever. I do, but you don't.
Well, then Keiko would not have been as upset when Miles wouldn't go with them when they abandoned the station, right?
Right.
She'd be like, you want to stay with Kira? Go ahead. See if I care.
Oh, Keiko would have complained just to complain.
Oh, Keiko.
No matter what.
All right. So you find Keiko to be a complainer?
Keiko is a complainer. I think she just likes saying, Miles, just whenever she can, as loud and as shrill as she possibly can. The only time that I really enjoyed DS9 Keiko was when she was possessed by something else, like she was possessed by an alien presence.
Well, I just watched, I believe it's Whispers is the name of the episode where, spoilers, Miles has been replaced, and we sort of follow the whole episode. But Keiko is like the worst actress of all time. She's like giving him weird looks. She won't let him touch her. It's like, go like visit your sister or something. You know, if you can't act like a wife, you're really blowing it for everyone, Keiko.
So I think we were talking about Lee Nalis.
We were talking about Lee Nalis.
Yeah, we were talking about Lee Nalis.
Oh, so okay. Tell me what you guys think. Now, I personally, and I may be the only person here, I felt that the casting of Lee Nalis was not very good. So we have here, we have Richard Boehmer, who's playing Lee Nalis. And I don't know. On the one hand, I can see that he's been in this Cardassian labor camp for 10 years. And I can see like his spirit is broken down and maybe he's physically exhausted. Mm-hmm. But as the trilogy goes on and we get later in, he becomes the first officer of the station. And I just feel like everything is so lethargic and so low key. And there's such this feeling of like, I don't want to be here. I know I'm Lee Nalis, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm the first officer. Okay. And then he'll give some like inspirational speech to people. And then he'll be back to like, well, is there anything I can do to help? I'd like to go take a nap if you don't mind. What did you guys feel about this? But I felt it was not just the writing, but it was also the acting in this case.
Well, I think a lot of the problem is that Lee Nallis is kind of a one-note character. I mean, we have to learn the secret that the Cardassian was in his underpants, and then Lee Nallis has to get over that and be a hero anyway.
Wait, the Cardassian was in Lee Nallis's underpants?
No, the Cardassian was in the Cardassian's underpants.
Okay.
See, I couldn't. That's something that I couldn't get past. I mean, whenever he was telling that story to Sisko, the people are like, okay, let's focus on what is a hero and what is a legend, what is a real man. All I could think of is, what does Cardassian underpants look like?
Is it? I mean, I always imagined like boxers. Like he's got the full Cardassian, you know, like high tech, really incredible makeup going on over the whole body, but then boxers.
I always imagined it was like that rubber armor that they always wear, but just in tidy whitey form.
That's what I was thinking.
But that was just me.
And it had like the little ventilation shaft on the front, but it was like the rubber thing that you peel back.
Yeah, like the wings on the side, kind of like Fry's Lightspeed briefs from Futurama. That's right. What I pictured.
Or it's like that special religious underwear that some groups have to wear.
Oh, I thought it was from the Canar of the Loom.
with Lee Nallis, the actor, I didn't have a big problem with him. I didn't think he was particularly casted very well, but I do agree with you, Chris, where he was only charismatic when he had to be, and that was because of the producers and writers, not because of the character himself.
A lot of moping around the station, I felt. I didn't really like the parts where he was the focus, especially after he had replaced Kira as the first officer of the station. I felt like all those parts were just really slow, and the story really fell flat whenever it focused on him.
I think it's a bigger problem at large with Trek guest actors. It's just really hard to bring someone onto Star Trek. Like if you've signed the 6-year contract, you've kind of bought into the premise at this point, and you're going to do it. You know your character. But a lot of the times when they get somebody just to do one episode or a couple episodes, they don't buy into the premise. They kind of half-ass it, and it comes across on screen. And I think it comes across on screen even more than in another show, because these are shows we watch over and over again. It's like, wow, I can't believe this guy is a part of Star Trek history. It goes back to, you know, well, there's TNG with the episode with a guy aging backwards. They just got a really bad guest star. But even when it's not a terrible guest star, someone like, there's Troy's boyfriend from Haven, or there's Crusher's grandmother's boyfriend from the 7th season. Yeah. And it's just like, you know, it's not a terrible actor, but it's not, you know, it's not Jonathan Frakes. Like Jonathan Frakes, LeVar Burton, Colm Meaney, Avery Brooks. These people bring a tour de force performance every week. You know, you have Robert Duncan McNeil acting his hearts out, even in Threshold. But these guest actors just, I don't feel like they bring it to the same level. And it just, this is just another example of that.
Are we really going to glance over the acting his hearts out joke? Or is that just for the hardcore fans listening at home?
Exactly.
That was actually the title of our Threshold episode.
Right.
Acting his heart out. Yes.
Quite a callback.
Yes.
That's hysterical.
But yeah, I know what you mean. It's not always the case. Now, there are cases where they get really excellent guest actors that actually show up the regular cast, except for maybe, of course, they're not going to show up, say, Patrick Stewart. But they might be playing against some of the other cast members, and they may show up. You know, like they may show up Tim Russ or something in Voyager. And that's not to say Tim Russ is bad. It's just to say sometimes you get these really great guest actors that steal the show. But most of the time...
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at Tuvix. The guy who played Tuvix was just excellent. Phenomenal. He could have been...
He was fantastic.
He could have played Tuvok or Neelix going forward. He was that good.
He was excellent. So, but yeah, it often does feel kind of... you know, they feel a little out of place sometimes, and it does happen when you come in and you're the guest in this ensemble cast. So that is very true.
Well, what did you think about Frank Langella coming in and sort of slumming it up as Vedic Wynn's lover? If we want to I don't really want to talk about that scene, but we can talk about Langella in general.
No, we have to talk about that scene because we have to talk about the good times and we have to talk about the travesties as well. I've never seen a scene that was so forced with sexual, I don't even want to complete the word. I mean, just tension. It wasn't even tension because it was so forced. I mean, I've actually used this scene as an example whenever I'm talking to other filmmakers or editors or writers. I was like, this is forced sexual tension and this is real sexual tension.
Right.
And, like, just even they don't look like they could go together. They don't sound like they could go together. And the characters themselves, just their character types, don't go together. Yeah. And I feel like Vedic Wynn is someone that you love to hate and is a great character. Frank Langella is a fantastic actor. Anywhere you see him. And it's just, they thought, okay, we'll bring these two, you know, unique people together, but it just was a casserole of nonsense.
Yeah. They needed each other for their political machinations that they had going. And Wynn, she may be a Vedic, she may be a religious leader on Bajor, but it's very clear from the moment she appears on the series just before this, and then starting in these episodes, that she's not really in it for the religion, and she's not in it to help the people, and she's not in it for the profits. No matter what she says, she's a politician. She cares about her own power. She sees this whole circle movement as an opportunity for her to become Kai. And then once she's Kai on Bajor, because the religion is so important, she kind of becomes the de facto leader of the planet. And of course, we see by the time we get to the seventh season what that leads to.
Yeah. I was going to ask Chris, is your problem with Wynn? I mean, you seem to hate every moment that Wynn is on screen. And it seems to go a little bit further than just the sort of villain you love to hate. I mean, the Borg, it's fun when the Borg show up and that sort of ongoing villain. But you seem to like really, really despise Wynn. I mean, what's gone into that for you?
As Tristan said, Wynn is a great character, and I will agree, and I think Brian has said that before when we've talked about Wynn as well, and probably you have too. I do think Wynn is a great character. She's very important to the way that the whole DS9 story unfolds, and I don't like Louise Fletcher, and so it's painful for me to watch her in the first place. Tristan, you find Rosalind Kao annoying as Keiko, but I actually have no problem with her. I find Louise Fletcher extremely annoying when she speaks. I can't watch her.
Yeah.
And
I'm completely with you, Chris. Yeah. I mean, that's why I said Kai Wynn is a great character, because I cannot stand the actress whatsoever. I am with you 100%. I like Keiko 100 times more than I like Louise Fletcher. I really do. Like you said, the way she speaks just grates on my nerves. Yeah. I always feel like she's acting like she's acting. She's not actually that person. She is Louise Fletcher who put on some makeup and a hat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't want to talk about any politicians who may be running for president, but there's a lot of people out there where you feel they're acting like they're acting, and you can't believe any of the words coming out of their mouth. They look like a plastered face up there on screen. Mm-hmm. And Fletcher plays that perfectly, and maybe it's just the actress herself, but I more hate Wynn than I hate Fletcher. And it's this, because I recognize it. I recognize her as that sort of person who doesn't even pretend sometimes. They know exactly how much they have to pretend to fool enough people. And then they just don't bother. And when they're around people like Kira, they just don't bother whatsoever. They're just like, no, I'm pretty much evil and there's nothing you can do about it. So screw you.
Well, that's probably a bit of it for me too. I mean, that's how I feel about Wynn. And so I just don't like the character, but it's effective. I mean, Wynn's an effective character, and Louise Fletcher is effective as an actress in the role throughout all the seasons of Deep Space Nine, especially in the final season as we lead up to the end of the war. So that's her. But seeing her, appearing here, as I'm watching these episodes, it's just like, yeah, this is where it all starts with the whole corruption of the Bajoran religion, yeah. The corruption of the Bajoran government, and Kai Winn. And it all starts right here.
Yeah. Do you think they knew at this point that they were going to make Vedic Winn be Kai down the road? Do you think they had all of that mapped out, or were they just sort of throwing some pieces in?
I think they knew that she was going to be Kai because there are too many references to it in the Circle and the Siege. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they had the whole thing with the prophets and the Pa Wraiths and everything that happened at the end of the series, and how she would basically become the archenemy of Sisko, and it would all play out. I don't know that they had all that in mind, but as far as her being the Kai, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely really interesting. I mean, this is the way to start a second season. I mean, these have got to be, I'm trying to think of the other second seasons, but this one gets it off on such a good foot. And it's not a reboot as much as it is just getting the show on the correct footing. And I want to bring this up. Yeah, a lot of Star Trek fans don't seem to like the Bajorans, and they ran this really big risk of people just not connecting with the Bajoran story whatsoever. And here they are jumping in with both feet. So, I mean, Chris, when you watched this originally, did you feel that TNG had introduced you to the Bajorans and then they were making it interesting? Or was it sort of losing you, but you went with it because you thought the regular Starfleet characters were interesting?
It wasn't losing me. It was very obvious that the Next Generation was setting up Deep Space Nine with their Bajoran stories in the later seasons there. When Ro first appeared, of course, she was just kind of random. Oh, I'm a Bajoran. But then they were setting it up. No, I don't think they were losing me in any way. And I never had a problem with the Bajorans, but this did help a lot to make me interested in the Bajorans to find out. But what about you, Tristan? Now, you watched this in first run as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. I never had a problem with the Bajorans like other people did. I wanted to see all aspects of the Star Trek universe. I wanted to see science. I wanted to see religion. I wanted to see traditions. I mean, I really like those little scenes where we see Kira praying with the fire and the smoke. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the religion in Klingon beliefs, and I liked seeing it in Bajoran beliefs. And I also thought that this beginning, like you said, was really kicking off Kai's political agenda, and also the trouble with bringing the Bajor as a planet into the Federation, which was the mission statement of the pilot, but then kind of we touched on a little bit later on, and then they were about to come in, and then Sisko had an episode and had to, you know, have them take them out of the running. And that, I think that was the main thing that I didn't like about the whole Bajor storyline, was that we never finished it with them coming into the Federation. Like, we never achieved our mission statement. To me, that would be like if the Voyager never made it home. That's kind of how I felt with the end of DS9. I mean, I was satisfied with every aspect of DS9 for the most part, except for Bajor not being absorbed into the Federation. So that was my only kick. But that's way down the future. Sorry, we're talking about the beginning of season two, and I'm talking about the end of season seven. So.
But going back to Kira, yeah, those scenes with her, you know, meditating with the candles, the visuals that they do for the Bajoran religion also, I think, are very interesting. And I have to say, for the writers, I really think Kira is probably the most interesting first officer, especially out of the gate of any of the series. The writers,
yeah.
let's not get crazy, Chris. Okay, she doesn't have three pips. She doesn't have a beard, and she also doesn't have the swagger. So
she also doesn't put her leg up on the console whenever they get a call on the view screen.
So she's second place at best. Let's just put it that way.
But seriously, from the very beginning, the writers, they really fleshed out Kira very well. They made her a very interesting multidimensional character from the start. And that's why I'm not going to say Kira is one of my favorite characters in Star Trek, But it is a character I really like because she's a very interesting character. And these three stories do a lot for continuing that development of her as well.
Yeah, I mean, you look at those early episodes of TNG with Riker, and Frakes talked about being really stiff early on and taking a while to find the character. I don't feel like Kira was ever stiff. They may have gone on some weird tangents with her from time to time. But I feel like Kira was always someone that was interesting. And what really strikes me about DS9, and Kira is a really good example of this, is it's a character that the actor plays. And there's less of this weird, let's try to figure out what sort of person the actor can play and then write for it. No, they had a specific idea and they made these characters happen. And Kira, just from day one, was that character. She continued to be that character.
I also really enjoyed when you look back on the entire 7-year run and you look at how every character progressed or changed, the Kira arc kind of snuck in. Like, once you realize who she was in season 7 and who she was in season 1, you realize how different she is, but they never betrayed the character once throughout the series. Mm. And that's what I really like about Kira. And like even how her quarters are decorated, or her religious beliefs, or just anything to do with her, even with her relationship with Odo, she would still get righteously pissed at Odo for the right reasons. Yeah. She wouldn't compromise her values. Mm-hmm. And I like, there's lots of things I love about Kira, including that scene where everyone started coming into her quarters.
Oh yeah. That scene was fantastic. And that was it was Corey Allen, I believe, directed that one. And that scene, it's one of those things where it just keeps going, right? Like, yes. Another actor enters the room, another actor enters the room, and it just keeps going. And you're like, aren't they going to cut and do a close up? But no, and that really also reinforced this family idea, mm-hmm. and how everyone, Kira meant something to everyone, even beginning of season 2.
It was a really good scene. And they also, the seeds of the whole Odo Kira relationship, mm-hmm. they're very obvious right here too. Yep. You didn't really, at the time, when you're watching this in first run, you didn't really connect those dots, I don't think. I didn't really, that like there was some, because this is still before you get into, is it Heart of Stone? Is that the name of the episode where they're trapped? That's when they first reveal these feelings.
Right.
But when you look back, you know, it's all right here. And I also love in this scene too, how everyone's in her quarters, and then Burial comes in. And then, in a moment, he becomes Dirty Vedic. And the look on everyone's faces is so hilarious. They're all like, like, they know exactly what he's up to.
Right.
Even though all he says is something like, do you have any immediate plans? Or, but he has that look on his face. You know, it's kind of like the office Christmas party where Dirty Santa is there. Ryle's like Dirty Vedic.
He is.
He always has that look. Like, he's going to finish every sentence with, if you know what I mean.
That's right. He does. You know,
like, there's another scene where, you know, you have to see a holy man in sexual tension, or a holy person with forced sexual tension, like with Kira and the Vedic with that orb vision.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I was watching this episode yesterday on the train on my iPad, and when we got to that scene, I was getting a little uncomfortable because everyone can see the iPad, right? And there's that in the orb vision where it's, of course, only from about shoulders up, but you've got Burial coming up behind Kira and stuff going on there. And it was a little bit too racy for a public viewing, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. The
only thing racier was the Troy's foot massage and lotion scene.
Oh, man.
Anybody else remember that?
Oh, that was uncomfortable.
You're so right, Greg, that they don't do boyfriends well.
Right.
They don't cast boyfriends well at all.
Yeah.
And Vedic Burial is probably the epitome of that, in my opinion.
I mean, they do it. I guess that was something we talked about on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
So we need to bring it up on the actual show. That, yeah, they don't seem to do the boyfriends right, or even the girlfriends, but especially they don't. It's better when they bring together two characters who are on the show, who are established, and they do it slowly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you end up with scenes like, yeah, with Troy getting the foot massage, or Crusher talking with Troy about this guy she's seeing, and it's the ghost. Scene. Does and it it's
make,
just
oh, that's a different one. No, I'm thinking of the other oh, one. When and then does it the make other your toes one. Curl?
The,
that oh, scene right. when Troy and Crusher are doing their stretches and yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. God!
Very uncomfortable.
That's
situation.
That's early TNG.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then but there's it, the Trill host.
Yeah. And the, then and the with the Trill and I mean those are three examples of like beginning of the show, middle of the show, end of the show, and they're all pretty horrible. Whereas, what they do with Troy and Worf. Never feels uncomfortable or gross. It's weird. Like I don't want them to end up together, but I never got that. Ugh, this is uncomfortable feeling that I yeah. always get when they try to bring a boyfriend on.
Yeah, maybe.
Or like with Paris and B'Elanna, you know, they took their time with it because they can, because they're both starring cast members, but when they bring in some random alien, they have to force it a romance really quick.
Yeah.
And I think the only time when two cast members didn't work together was at the very last episode of Voyager with Chakotay and Seven of Nine.
Oh, that was just kind of, yeah. I mean, they had a couple of dates.
I try to think of that not happening.
Leading up to that. But yeah, I mean...
Well, that was holographic, though.
Yeah.
That wasn't even Chakotay. Oh, that was holographic.
That's
Chakotay.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, Worf and Dax worked really well. Kira mm-hmm. and Odo worked really well for me. B'Elanna and Tom worked really well. Trip and T'Pol, I thought, worked well mm-hmm. on Enterprise.
Yeah.
The only one that really got me was the Worf-Troy thing, I thought, was too abrupt. It didn't make any sense, and it happened right at the end. Yeah. And then the whole thing in the original series, the whole Sulu Rand relationship, I never got. So
they didn't quite have. Oh, wait, they didn't quite have chemistry.
That was an iMessage conversation.
Yes, it was.
Had. Sorry about that.
Oh. Who was? Okay. I'm trying to remember. The name of Sisko's girlfriend because I'm still at the beginning of DS9.
Cassidy
yeah. Yates.
Cassidy Yates.
That worked really well too because they did that slowly and Sisko never had some weird creepy conversation with I don't know who would he've had a creepy conversation with Bashir or something about like does she make your toes curl?
No, it would have been Dax. He would have had the conversation with Dax.
I guess. Yeah.
Absolutely, Dax.
But they
that's another character where I like the character, but I don't like the actress. Like, I can't stand Penny Johnson.
Oh, really? Don't.
I think it's because of leftover hate from 24.
That could be.
I think that's maybe what it is.
Mm. I could see that. I do suppose. No, Cassidy really works for me. I believe she even was in another role. I think she was on TNG briefly on one episode.
She was, it was the episode... where Worf's brother tried to save a race of people.
Oh.
And so they transported them on the ship.
Yeah, that's...
And she was the
I think she's
wife
the,
of
the brother's
brother.
Girlfriend, wife.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, she
Baby
is.
Mama.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
That's right. Yeah, that's right at the end of the series. Yeah.
It was. Yeah, it was part of that final season, let's go ahead and cast the new show thing that seems to happen. Well, they were casting for Voyager, and then they were apparently casting for DS9. In that last season of TNG, it was interesting. But anyway, that's a relationship that worked. But none of the boyfriends seem to work. And here's Burial. And Burial's not even just for these three episodes. I mean, he continues to be a big factor in the show, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not wrong about that.
For a long time.
For a long time.
And does it ever improve for you guys? Or is he always this weird...
He improves a little bit, I think. I mean, it's not one of my favorite characters, but I think that because he and Kira do have this kind of ongoing relationship, that it's something that you get used to it a little bit more. It's not quite as startling as it is here early on,
right.
At least for me. I don't know. Tristan, I don't think agrees, but...
I just don't. I don't like him. I liked him when he had a mechanical brain, but that's about it.
Oh, yes, that's right. He did have a mechanical brain.
Mechanical brain. Apparently, I need to watch the rest of DS9 really quickly. I just mainline TNG, and I'm trying to get through DS9. I don't remember these... Mechanical brain, I don't remember that episode.
No, there's no rush. It's only been off the air for 20 years. You know, it's cool. You know,
I saw it. I watched it like 2 years ago, and I've been
Greg
watching, you know, here and there.
Before. He's seen all of DS9. It's just not
Oh, you have seen all of DS9.
Yeah, I've seen all of DS9. I've probably seen the entire show at least once, and I've seen most of the episodes. I've seen a good number of the episodes twice. Yeah. But yeah, this is the show I probably know the least about, especially when it comes down to individual episodes.
The problem, there are just so many episodes of Star Trek. I mean, I've seen all the series, and I've seen every episode at least twice. I've probably seen most episodes 5-6 times or more.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of them that I still haven't seen in the last 4 or 5 years, just because there's just so many episodes. And as I make my way back through one, then those other ones kind of fade. You know, the details can kind of fade a little bit. So. But I mean, Greg is watching. I seriously, how many episodes of Star Trek do you watch every day? 3?
Yeah.
4?
Well, I watch at least 2 episodes a day as of right now, because I'm trying to have done a full watch through of the 80s to 90s shows. And it's really hard. I mean, and then when there's like a weak episode and you want to just turn it off for a couple days. when there's like a string of great episodes, like when I finally got to the last half of TNG season 7, it's like, oh yeah, I watched like all of it over July 4th, because it's really good. It's just worth watching. But then I'm watching DS9. It's like, oh yeah, she can, she's from a planet where they have lower gravity, so she wants her quarters to put her on wires, and now Bashir's going to fall in love with her. Okay. All right.
That's Melora. Yeah.
That's Melora.
So, I know. You have just, to get through the first
you gotta
season.
You got to be hardcore.
Yeah, of DS9. But no, I mean, yeah, even if you watch 2 or 3 episodes of Star Trek a day, it's like, it's, you have to cycle through them over the
there's
years.
There's always
to, like,
something
the
you haven't
fresh
seen.
In your head. In a, so, yeah.
Yeah. There's always something you
that's,
haven't seen
that's
in a couple
pretty
years.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I do is I start with TOS, go all the way through to Enterprise, and then cycle back.
Go back again, yeah.
Well, how long does that circuit take you, Tristan?
Oh, geez, it depends. I mean, you know, when I was single, I could do it very, very fast. But no, I'd say, I don't know, because I work in editing and graphic design, I can always have an episode going on in the corner of my screen. Right, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I honestly can't tell you, because it fluctuates, because TOS is more of a chore to get through for me. But, you know, like Deep Space Nine is probably the one that I can get through the fastest.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I'm hoping to transition, as you can tell, I'm doing the photography, I'm doing the filming. I'm trying to transition away from my locked in a dark room for 10 hours job so that I can have a TV running. I was over at a vodka distillery the other day, and they just have a big TV with a PlayStation with Netflix attached to it. And they're just running Battlestar Galactica on marathon all day. And I'm so jealous of them.
So say we all.
Well, that's, but like you, Tristan, with me, I mean, being a designer, you know, and I have the big setup with the two big screens in front of me, huge desktop and everything. So I just have an episode running like in one little portion of the screen there. But but of course, when you do that, you're also passively viewing, you know, because you're actually working on something that you've got it. So you kind of take in some of the details, but then a lot of it goes by you, and then
you're not able to sit down and live tweet like I do.
Oh gosh, yes, Greg's live tweeting. Just quite hilarious. But
I'm either live tweeting or I'm live iMessaging Chris, or a combination of the two.
It's usually both,
depending on what mood I'm in.
That's right.
And before we forget about the rest of the episodes, I want to ask one question. Okay, are we really supposed to be scared of a Bajoran fighting force that's coming towards
that
the station?
The next thing that I wanted to talk about, two things here. First, Tristan, as you said, are we going to be scared of this Bajoran force that's approaching the station? And then when they come out of the airlock, I mean, seriously, it's like the Bajoran military is sponsored by Vidal Sassoon.
It's like a Vidal Sassoon commercial
coming at you. It's like, how much hair product is going around the Bajoran military? They've all got fluffy hair. They've got wings. You know, you think they're going to break out into a Flock of Seagulls concert. I don't know what's going on, but they were all, I thought, way too pretty to be a fighting force.
And I always love it that whenever you see the station invaded, like except for the huge Klingon battle, later on, it's always just like five people that come through an airlock and mm-hmm. they're going to take over the station yeah. that's inhabited by thousands of people. Now, granted, it's a TV show. You can't show like you can't show a force that huge taking over a station, but you could at least like get the same people, shoot them in different directions and have them come through different airlocks, like use the same actors, but just in different yeah. angles and give the illusion that a huge army is coming.
Well,
coming
forth. Don't you understand when Steven Weber shows up, you just give up. There's nothing you can do against the force of the Weber.
You know,
that's true.
My first thought when Steven Weber showed up was that I was wondering if Loyal was back there helping O'Brien fix the runabouts so that they could get everyone off the station.
Right.
Then I was going to go over to the bar and order some scrambled eggs and some toast while I waited on my airplane to take off. But oh man. It was really something because, you know, yeah. Wings was on the air at the same time that this was on
the air. It was, right?
Yeah, it was so strange. Like, really weird casting going on here. Oh, man.
Right.
But yeah. Talking about the Bajorans, though, one thing I did want to talk about here was that I felt like this whole concept, it was a great proof of concept of what Deep Space Nine could be when they mm-hmm. did this three-part story. And I thought that the idea was excellent. It was very interesting, but it really dragged in a lot of places, and I felt like the writing was very shallow much of the time. And a lot of that played out here. Once the Bajoran force came onto the station, the fact that, oh, they thought the Federation had tucked its tail and ran.
Yeah.
And then you see Lee Nollis and O'Brien and Sisko hiding in this ventilation shaft, cuddled up there together. And then finally, when these Bajoran, the occupation force, which was, like you said, about like five people, when they go into this cargo bay and then everyone pops out of barrels and Bashir kicks the grill off from the ceiling, it all came off as kind of silly to me.
Yeah.
It's like surprise. It's like a surprise party in the cargo bay, basically. And then yeah. Bashir has his George W. Bush line. He calls Sisko and he says, "Mission accomplished."
Yeah.
He actually says, "Mission accomplished."
He does.
And I crack up laughing every time awesome. I hear it now. Of course, I didn't at the time, but now in retrospect, I do.
Right.
And also it cracks me up because they didn't really do anything. It's like these people come in the cargo bay and they see someone in a barrel and they see Bashir up in the ceiling with guns. And so they drop their weapons and they surrender. There's no struggle. There's no fight. It yeah. all just seems so easy. And I felt like yeah. the story could have been so much better if the writers had actually built more drama and built more conflict into this story. I'd love to see this story yeah. done like in season 7 DS9. What would it be
right.
like?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, and this is always, and this kind of Star Trek's problem is in the resolution. Like they set up really great stuff, but when they get around to wrapping it all up, it's not always, but it's very typically extremely weak. I mean, you look at Best of Both Worlds Part 2, pretty weak. How they end up wrapping up Unification was just kind of weak. The end of Voyager. And it's just, and here's another case of it, where if they let this storyline fester for like the whole season, it could have been really cool. And maybe leave some threads dangling, but they kind of, they wanted to wrap up the entire Circle storyline. I guess they left Wynn there. That's good. But they wanted to wrap up the Circle storyline, but they didn't have the money or budget or any really interesting ideas. They just wanted to wrap it up. So they just did. And oh, there it is. It's on the air now.
Well, I think one of the main reasons, and I give them a little slack, especially with this first arc, with doing that, because this is the first time that they're experimenting with an over 2-episode arc. And,
right.
you know, ever since TOS and TNG, we've only been exposed to single storylines where everything's wrapped up. And at the end of the episode, I mean, this was a syndicated show, just like TNG. And this was everything lived from 1 week to the next, and that's it. Like, had a 1 week shelf life. And so they didn't want to push it too much. They're like, okay, we're going to give them 3 episodes. That's a lot. Let's see if they can handle it.
Yeah.
And then after they were done, they realized, oh, we got a great response. They can handle it. Let's do it some more. So I kind of feel like this is a test run where if, like you guys said, like if this was season 7, the Circle definitely would have been a season long arc of, you know, of craziness.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of disappointing that they set up this whole idea that the Cardassians were supplying weapons to the Circle, and there was all this conflict happening in the capital city, and there was a tension within the government between this group, which we call the Circle, but they're actually the Alliance for Global Unity, and then you have the religious angle as well. And I would have liked to have seen this take the rest of season 2 to kind of wind down.
Yeah.
Because in reality, nothing like this can be tied up so cleanly.
Yeah.
The way that they hand the station back over to Sisko at the end, it was like, well, oh yeah, the provisional government has prevailed. And in light of that, I feel that I should hand the station back over to you, Commander Sisko. It's like all this fighting was going on, and then it's suddenly like, you know what? I think everything's okay now. So here's your station back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like you said, it's an experiment. It's an experiment with doing an arc. And I think in the end, they recognized the value of doing longer arcs. I don't know how soon they get back to doing it. Pretty much every episode I've seen in season 2 after this is a single self-contained episode. But that's kind of what you expect from Star Trek, because that's what you do. And that's worked really well for them. And so it's kind of astonishing that they even tried 3 episodes this early on, because no one in TV knew if it was even possible to do it. So I kind of give them a pass for not quite sticking the landing.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was before the time, you know, these days most shows are serialized like that. This was before that was the way that shows were produced in Hollywood on television. So it was an experiment. So I agree with you. I mean, I'm glad they tried it. And it is interesting. I mean, it's an interesting set of episodes, but it was like a proof of concept. And luckily it did lead to what we see, especially after the Jem'Hadar at the end of season 2. Mm-hmm. I mean, they started doing it like late in season 2. You do have this long string of things like, you know, the rules of acquisition and rivals and whispers and shadow play, where they're on that planet where they're like facing it out of time. You do get towards the end of the season, you get the Maquis two-parter, which helps both to set up Voyager, and it helps to kind of take DS9 a little bit more towards this. There's more conflict going on. And then you get with the Jem'Hadar. And then in season 3, you start to get a little bit more of that. Each episode is building towards something else. And then it really kicks in later on, like season 4 and 5.
Right. Well, once TNG ended, I actually just watched the hour-long special that they played. I think it was before All Good Things, back in 94. And it's like half of it is like retrospective on TNG, but then another quarter of it is, oh yeah, we have this whole other Star Trek show on, and Colm Meaney's on it. It's really cool. You ought to check it out. There's a wormhole.
You remember Colm. You like him, right?
He's in All Good Things. He's standing there next to Troy when Picard comes.
Looking all important, like he's a big shot on the ship.
He's really important. And then another bit of it is, and we have this movie coming. And then, oh, and there's a new show that we can't tell you anything about, but it's called Voyager, and we can't say anything. Anyway, but they're like really plugging DS9, because you could tell people didn't know about it and weren't really watching it. So it's after TNG ends that when I'm watching DS9, I'd be like, oh, they really kicked it up. They brought Worf on. They started doing these really interesting multi-level arcs. I mean, they set up the Dominion before that. I mean, you talk about, I think it was Rules of Acquisition, where they like drop in a reference to the Dominion.
Yeah, that's true.
But it takes them a little while to really kickstart DS9.
Who are the Dominion, to get into that.
Once the DVDs came out of DS9, I feel like that's when people really started hitting it hard and became fans and became Niners. And a lot of people, I've seen, they don't start, like, people don't if people want to get into DS9, people don't say start with season one.
Right.
They say start with season four.
Oh, yeah.
They say start with season four because you get introduced to everything because Worf is getting introduced to everyone and everything. And you're kind of along with him. The audience is along for the ride with Worf. And then once you're done, you're like, oh, wait, I got three more seasons of these characters that I love.
Yeah.
So
there's absolutely a through line from all of Star Trek, all of Next Gen, All Good Things, Generations, and then right into Worf's first episode of DS9. It's like you can just follow him and then use him as your introduction to the series. That makes an awful lot of sense.
But yeah, I tell people that actually too, Tristan, that, you know, I tell them DS9 is a great series. It's my favorite series. But if you start on it, you know, you might not want to start with season one because the first season definitely, and the first two seasons are not really indicative of the series. And I think a lot of people can go into season one and be kind of like Greg is with his rewatch right now, of kind of being like, I'm trying to struggle my way through DS9, because it does feel that way in the beginning. But if you jump in the middle and you get to the end, then you feel like, wow, I want to know the backstory. I want to know what happened that led up to all of this. And then you can go back and do seasons one and two and even three.
Huh, that sounds like a really... I ought to think about that and mention that to people, because that's sort of... There's that alternate way of watching Star Wars where it's... I think... I'm trying to remember the order, but they figured out where... Oh, you watch four and five, and then you go back and watch one, two, three before watching the last one. Because if you start with the prequels, it just doesn't, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, Jar Jar is to the Star Trek universe what Move Along Home is to Deep Space Nine.
Exactly.
So,
Misa a la Marin. Come with Misa.
So you don't want to, you don't really want to do that, but.
Right.
All right. I think we hit most all the major points in here. Do you have any other thoughts, final thoughts on the whole Circle trilogy, how it played into DS9, or anything that stood out to you in the stories that we didn't touch on?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think we've covered most of it. I mean, it was interesting watching season seven of Next Gen and seeing a couple crossovers, and you could tell they had this larger world that they were developing. And it kind of actually made me sad that Voyager was set in the Delta Quadrant and that they couldn't really do Voyager DS9 crossovers, because they weren't like doing it solidly, but like, okay, Riker can do a long distance call to Quark and that can be fun. Just various things, just mentioning the Cardassian War, mentioning the Bajorans, setting up the thing with the Maquis. Those are great little crossovers that they can get because both shows are set in the Alpha Quadrant. But then Voyager is this whole other thing. And I feel like a lot of fans were able to go from Next Gen to Voyager and ignore DS9 completely.
Well, that's what happened.
It's a real missed opportunity.
I was going to say a minute ago that, I mean, DS9 really got screwed over. And because not only did Voyager come, Voyager premiered at the same time Generations hit the theaters. It was that same little time period right there. But not only was Voyager coming on, but it was the pilot show, flagship show for UPN, because, you know, Paramount, they had had a few false starts of trying to start their own TV network. And then they finally did it with UPN. And they knew that the property that they owned that was going to bring in people was Star Trek. And so all the media attention was on Paramount starting its own network, and there's this new TV show coming out. And DS9 just kind of got lost in the whole shuffle of the end of the Next Generation, the Generations movie, and the launch of Voyager. And so like Tristan said, when the DVDs finally came out, and now you have Netflix as well, you have that opportunity to go back and really watch DS9 now. But at the time, it really got lost in what was going on. And I think it was underappreciated all the way to the end. And then, you know, Voyager was still going on after DS9 went off the air, and then they were working on Enterprise. And so I often call DS9, you know, the forgotten stepchild of Star Trek, and it, it really is like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And DS9 is like you said, and like we both said about fans flocking to it on DVD, is that now there are, you can name off a huge list of shows that are more fun to watch on DVD or Netflix than when they're on the air because of the ongoing storyline. Like 24 or Battlestar Galactica, you just want to keep watching. You want to watch a disc a night if you can. And DS9 is like that, but with Voyager, TNG, even Enterprise, like you watch one episode and you're like, okay, cool, that's good. You know, I'm fine till next week.
Yeah.
But you just want more when you watch DS9.
Yeah. So I guess my last thing to say about these episodes is that I feel oftentimes like it's very, if you're watching it for the first time, if you've started DS9 from season one and you've moved into season two and you're watching these and you don't actually know the whole DS9 story yet, there are a lot of really slow moments in here. And there are a lot of things where you feel like maybe it's almost like they're padding for time at some points, which was kind of disappointing because I felt the resolution was so weak in the siege, the way that everything was wrapped up. And they had three episodes to work with. And I felt like, let's work on time management and the story here. And let's make the resolution more interesting instead of lingering on some of these moments for so long through the three. But if you know the whole DS9 story to the end, these three episodes are quite interesting to go back and watch because you can watch for the character moments and the interactions between different characters and also how characters evolved over time. You know, Rom is a great example. Rom in this episode is nothing like Rom that we have in the later seasons. And you can see how Rom is sort of like the Ferengi interested in profit still at this point. And he just happens to be Quark's brother. And he's basically there to help develop Quark's character. Whereas Rom becomes his own person as the series goes on. And you can be interested simply in Rom himself. So these are great to go back and watch after you've been all the way through the series as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Tristan, thanks for joining us this week. We're glad that you finally made it back from last week's excursion. And of course, everyone knows you from Hyper Channel, I hope. And if they don't, they need to go to trek.fm/HC immediately and watch you deliver the Star Trek news each week in video form. And besides that, tell everyone where they can find you.
Well, I primarily want you to find me on Hyper Channel because it's a fantastic show and I love doing it and I love being a part of Trek.fm. But if you want to find me in another avenue, you can find me on Twitter. I am on most every day. I'm at The Insane Robin on Twitter. And one thing that I've started doing that kind of has been catching on is my Star Trek question of the day. And it can range from anything from, if you went to the academy, what would you study? To if you could have a cast member plan your birthday party, who would it be? And it's actually kind of funny because no one really talks to me about anything else now.
Only Star Trek.
It's just, oh no, it's all, like, I love, like the whole reason why I have a Twitter account is for Star Trek, but all they talk about is the Star Trek question of the day.
Nice.
So I usually ask it about 10:30 Central. Is about the time I ask it, but of course I'll accept answers all day.
Yeah, I'm occasionally around when you ask it. I answered the one the other day of who would you invite to a party from the Next Generation crew, and of course my answer was Barclay because we could finally, he would bring his family members with him and we could finally find out which one of them is a spider.
And I think we answered that question, Chris. We found out that Peter Parker is actually an ancestor of Barclay.
That's correct.
That makes a lot of sense. But yeah, I'm not even supposed to have my phone like with me while I'm at my desk at work, but I have to. At about 8:30, I've been at work about half an hour, 45 minutes. I pull up Twitter and I have to see what the Star Trek question of the day is so I can answer it. It's a part of my routine now.
It is great.
Oh, fantastic.
So everyone, go follow Tristan at The Insane Robin. And of course, you can find a link to that on the show page for this episode. Just look for his name and click away.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Well, it's always fun to jump into DS9 and talk about it. I think my brain, as I'm talking about, is going to start switching over to DS9 from TNG. It's a bit of an awkward transition, honestly, between season 7 of TNG and season 2 or 3 of DS9. But I'm managing it. It's going okay. I'm really looking forward to those episodes with the Jem'Hadar and where the Dominion really starts in. Because I remember that being when DS9 was started to be interesting to me.
Well, and look at it this way, Greg. There's another perk here for you with DS9. Now that you have finished your Empress Hoshi figure, it's going to give you time to work on your Intendant figure.
That's very true.
You get Nana Visitor in her black leather. You can put it right next to your Empress Hoshi figure. So you're all set there.
That's
but yeah, it is fun to talk about DS9. And it's, again, just so many interesting facets to the show. So yeah. Great that we could do that. And Greg, another thing I should mention before we go is some exciting news for our network here is that this week, possibly should be, by the time this show drops, just the next day, on Wednesday, we're going to be launching a new show that I'm very excited about. Now, our listeners are all familiar with Colin, who hosts Trek News and Views on Trek FM. And I've been working together with Colin to pull together a new show that's called Deck 8. And for those who aren't familiar with the reference, that is a reference to the location of Riker's quarters. And Deck 8 is a show dedicated to Star Trek Online. And Colin has a permanent co-host, Thomas Baddeley. And they're both going to be coming to us from England for each episode. And they're going to be covering Star Trek Online news. They're going to have tips and tricks for the advanced players, as well as a look at the game for beginning players. So it's very exciting. It'll be our first, you know, you and I talk about Star Trek Online occasionally during the news segments, but we don't really delve into it. Colin is a longtime player of STO, and he sometimes does STO segments during Trek News and Views, so I'm really looking forward to having his insight about the game every week in a dedicated show, and I hope all the listeners like that too. So once it is launched, you can find it in iTunes and on Stitcher like all of our shows, and it will live on the site at trek.fm/D8, and tune in.
I'm looking forward to listening to that. Actually, one of the things I listen to is video game podcasts, even though I don't have much time for video games. So I'm looking forward to hearing this one, seeing what's going on in STO. Maybe it'll give me extra impetus to install Windows on Boot Camp on my Mac and do all the stuff to jump into the game. Yeah, really looking forward to hearing that first episode.
Yeah. So welcome, Tom, to the network, and tune in and hear what they have to say. All right, Greg. Well, let's tell everyone where they can contact us if they want to share their thoughts on anything we've talked about today in the news. If they want to let us know what they think about the Circle Trilogy, just go to trek.fm/contact and you can send us a message through there. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmg+, and of course you can find us on Twitter at username trekfm. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
Well, that's right. Well, I'm there on Twitter tweeting from Trek FM from time to time. I'm also there at TOS Season 4, and that's TOS_Season 4. There I post with Drew various, you know, episodes from the Lost season, including this one, a transporter accident splits Spock into his human and Vulcan sides. The crew decides to keep both until the human side shouts too much.
Oh, that's a continuation of that. Okay.
Yes.
I saw that one, but I didn't catch the continuation of it. Ah,
I see. Okay. Yes.
So they didn't want Spock Bob shouty pants anymore.
They didn't. They just, and it turns out it was the Vulcan half was the only half keeping that in all that time.
Now it all makes perfect sense.
Yes. So you can find me and Drew posting there, as well as I'm at my personal account. That's Greg Harbin. That's GregHarb, as in boy, IN, where I'm pretty much just posting about my new addiction to pop music. So if you care about pop music as well, follow me, I guess. I don't know.
Yes. And hopefully Greg will post some videos of himself as well. And then you can enjoy, as I have been throughout the show recording today, watching Greg dance to music every time we have a break. And he fires up the iPad and just starts getting down, basically.
Yes, indeed.
All right. You can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And recently, I have been tweeting as I speculate about the English that I see on T-shirts and hats of the people sitting across from me on the train. You just you never quite know what someone's going to write on a t-shirt in Japan in English that makes yes. very little sense. And I'm actually thinking of starting another podcast where that's all we talk about. So stay tuned. Find out if I do that. All right, Greg. Well, we better head out. I've got my bright green spray paint here. I'm going to run next door and paint a big circle emblem on my neighbor's door.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick my number in it, because the Ready Room is done.